Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is Dr. Carrie Burnight, a nationally recognized gerontologist and the author of Joyspan. Dr. Carrie has spent more than 2 decades working directly with older adults and families, and her groundbreaking book, Joyspan, reframes aging by focusing on joy, not just lifespan or healthspan, as a measure of well-being. Dr. Carrie, welcome to Roundtable Talk. We're so excited to have you with us today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. Now, your book, Joyspan, as I was mentioning, reframes aging by focusing not just on how long we live, but how much joy we experience along the way. What inspired you to write Joyspan?
So I had the honor of being a gerontologist now for 31 years. And the beginning of my career, so the first 20, I worked with people in the roughest situations, people who endured elder abuse, financial exploitation, really profound loneliness. And I thought that I would do that for the rest of my career because it was filling a need. But I had this epiphany when I was flying home from a DC event where we were talking about our work in elder abuse, because the research shows us the things that can fortify us for these long lives. And we, like, waiting until people go through all this suffering is too late. So I thought, wow, this information from our research isn't necessarily getting out in a Barnes & Noble type book. What if I were to write that book to try to fortify people internally the way that we've gotten so we fortify our bodies externally? And I've just been amazed by, like, who would think that a book on aging would become a New York Times bestseller? I mean, that's where people are in recognizing these new 100-year lives and recognizing that the status quo is not sufficient.
I love that. Yeah, and you know, it's such an interesting and motivating point, I think, where you didn't see a book out there that was on what you wanted to read, and so you wrote it yourself.
Right. And there were times where I would, you know, had my head down on the keyboard crying because it was so hard, because I kept wanting, of course, I wanted to bring in all the research, but I also wanted to make it really readable.
Sure. And so that's what I love about the book
kept thinking, simplify. People are busy. People are on to their next thing. So, and I've had a lot of people listen to it on Audible as well. And to see it, like, in the popular vernacular and on, you know, TV shows and things, it's really like, this is happening.
Absolutely. That's great. And, you know, we've been hearing things like we were saying, you know, well-span, you know, health span, lifespan, obviously. But I do love the concept of joy span. And in this book, you highlight joy as being more than just a fleeting emotion. It's a vital indicator of how fully we're living, especially as we age. Why do you believe joy is a critical measure of longevity and well-being?
Well, you know, lifespan, of course, how many years you live. Health span, how many in good health. And it was lacking the well-being component. And so I thought about well span because it is about well-being. That's what we talk about in the literature. It's just that when I said wealth span, my patients thought that I was saying wealth span, which matters too and is a thing. And there's a book, Wealth Span. But when I realized that the American Psychological Association defines joy as well-being and satisfaction, it made me realize that joy isn't this, like, happy, happy, you know, it's the opposite of toxic positivity. In fact, the Dalai Lama.
Interesting.
Yeah, the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu came together and wrote a book. And what they said is that happiness is often circumstantially dependent, whereas joy can exist even in challenge because it's an inside out phenomena. And that was an aha moment for me, because in I don't know any older adults who haven't had significant challenges. That is the nature of being a human. And we're going to have those challenges. So it isn't that we're going to control for everything. That's impossible. It's that we're going to find a way to have joy anyway.
That's great. You know, and I've I was talking with a friend recently who was saying that, you know, she just wasn't happy. And, you know, I was thinking about that, and happiness, like you just said, it can be very situational, very fleeting. And, you know, I think that's almost more, without getting into the science of it, which I wouldn't be, you know, able to talk about, but I mean, it seems like if that might be more endorphin or driven by some of the chemical rather than just really the contentedness, the joy that you can bring. And I know contentedness sometimes, you know, is seen as a negative, you know, just being content, but I think there's something to being at peace.
I love it. I mean, I love if content span was a word, I would have liked it too, because it is that in traveling these journeys with thousands of adults, you know, I have people who have really objectively heartbreaking circumstances, and yet there is that joy, that is that content. And I was just crazy to find out why. Like, why are two people, I mean, my own grandmothers, one, they both had the same socioeconomic status, both were widows, both had the same physical conditions, some being quite painful, and one utterly suffered. And it was such a rough road, and it was really hard to be around her. And then the other one had found this ability to be content, and we couldn't get enough of her. And her legacy just really, really lives on because we watched that it is possible to walk with grief and joy.
Hmm. Thank you for sharing that. That's kind of a beautiful sentiment. But your book encourages readers to see joy as something measurable and intentional, not just accidental. How can people begin to identify the joy span in their own lives?
So the measures that I use have been used in tens of thousands of studies, and they're from Carol Reif's Psychological Well-Being Inventory. And she spent her entire career, I think it's coming on 40 years, she and thousands of other researchers testing these measures. And so I reached out to her to say, how can we apply this to longevity? And she said, you absolutely can. I made the measures public, but I'm busy with my academic part. Like, I don't want to do a lay book. So I was like, okay. So I took it from there. And what I realized, we couldn't use just the exact it's the psychological well-being inventory, because there was one component that really was lacking, and that is the ability to adapt. So there was researchers out of Israel who had done a lot of research on adaptability. And so I used measures from their study to create the joy span matrix of like well-being and longevity. How do you measure it? And how do you improve it? And it ended up being that there were four components that the research showed us: people who thrive in longevity, people who enjoy their long lives anyway, do these four things. And they're all verbs. So that is, it's much more akin to physical health. We know that we need to do cardiovascular health, strength training. We need to do agility training and balance training. We don't just look at people and think, oh, you're just lucky. We recognize that every day people are investing in their physical strength. And the same is true with our internal strength, that there are four components. And I'll list out those four, and I'm sure we'll dig in deeper later. But those four verbs are growing, connecting, adapting, and giving. And people who find ways to operationalize those investments of time and those decisions are people who enjoy 100-year, 110-year lives.
That's great. Now, what misconceptions do you think people have about joy and aging?
Yes, I think a big one is we see people aging well, mm-hmm. you know, and we think, oh man, those genes, I'd like to have those genes. But what the research shows us is that genetics predicts between 13 and 25% of our aging experience. So the vast majority is up to us. So I think one of the misconceptions is about like, oh, it's just luck or genetics. Or you think, oh, my mom aged well, therefore I will. Or my mom aged horribly or passed away early and I will. And both of those are not true. So that's one. And another misconception is that joy is just a great big like smiley face. And it's not. And I mean, I hate toxic positivity, frankly. I think burying things and putting our head in the sand doesn't work, and it makes my patients suffer more. So I think a misconception about joy is that it has to look like this. A lot of times, you know, I was just at a lovely senior housing community the other day, and there was a woman sitting and looking out the window, just so tranquil. And I thought, as I looked at her, I don't know if she's experiencing joy or if she's experiencing profound loneliness, because you can't always tell from the outside. So of course I went and sat down and talked with her, and she was in fact experiencing such a contentment. She had a tree and a bird that she was, and she had these deep thoughts, and I think that's a misconception. And one more misconception is that you're just born with it. Like, you know, there's Eeyores and there's Tiggers, and you just are what you are. And like, if you're an Eeyore, like,
That's such a great way to sum it up. Cause you're
right. Yeah. And so what I've seen is that people can, you don't have to be, you know, extroverted. You don't need to be jumping up and down to have a real contentment in longevity. And, that we can talk about the topic, and people do it like in that senior housing the other day, when we started talking about the issue, I mean, people all came together. We all sat down because we all recognize that joy is actually a real thing, and it is something worth pursuing.
Sure. Now I love those four verbs. Grow, I think, makes intellectual sense. Everybody wants to keep, well, I shouldn't say everybody wants to, but I think those who successfully find joy want to keep growing. We all know about the importance of social engagement and, you know, maintaining those connections. But, you know, feel free to talk a little about those. But also, I'm curious about adapting. That makes a whole lot of sense. But that's one that I haven't necessarily thought about. But that is so important.
Yes.
Until I read your book. But
so if we touch on grow first, I think one thing that's really important is that we have been fed a steady diet of inaccurate information about growing older. And that information is that it's all decline. And the truth is in the literature that there are many things that get better as you get older, but we don't hear about them because the anti-aging industry is fueled by fear. And when you give the actual information about the things that get better, it's not lucrative, but it really matters. In fact, people who endorse and believe these accurate age beliefs live on average 7.5 years longer and actually have different inflammation markers. So if this was a drug, we would all be clamoring for it. So the reality is, what we know is that as we get older, we don't care as much what people think about us. Love it. I'm only 56 yep. And I'm already getting a nice taste. We appreciate our connections more, and we kind of know who our people are more than we did when we were younger. We have greater potential for problem solving, in fact, because of the neurological integration of our left and right hemisphere that is largely built on the fact that we've solved a lot of problems. So, you know, you need to know that about yourself as an aging person, because the society will tell us, oh, if you don't know this tech or that tech, we need to step in and say, like, yeah, I might not know that tech, but I know problem solving, and that's way more important than these solutions that you're offering. Other things, we can have a greater appreciation of music and art and nature, a greater potential for depth in our spirituality, and also greater potential for humility, which would matter so much in today's society. So like with this thing about growth, when we're young, they're continuing to push us. They'll say, you know, jump off the high dive, learn long division, get there in the soccer goal and give it a try. And that humans need to continue to develop, but somehow we have stopped that in our older years. And, you know, I'm finding again in my 50s, sometimes I'm not pushed to get out of my comfort zone. So I recognizing the literature and pushing myself to do things that I'm not good at, to, you know, continue to do hard things and to explore curiosities. And you'll find that people who love their 100-year lives have sparked their curiosity and are pursuing those things. So that's what the growth is about. As you said, connection, there's quite a bit about people kind of know this one, that you need to be proactive in your connection, and that the Harvard Longitudinal Study showed that it was the greatest predictor, more than all of the other variables. It was the extent to which people had meaningful social connections. And then that brings us to your point, is you don't hear as much about adapting. And adapting is two things. It's the desire to adjust to changing circumstances, but it's also the ability. So it takes both of those. So sometimes I was recently with a woman who lost her husband of 60 years, and it's been a year, and she said, I'm never going to be happy again the rest of my life. Basically, she didn't say sucks, but that's kind of what she was giving to me. And that is a choice. So she didn't have the desire, like, you know, like I just, and so when I would offer things, I was like, well, how about reading? You used to like reading. Oh no, my husband and I read books at the same time. That was something we did together. I'm not going to read now that he's dead, right? So she didn't have the desire, and it's something that we're working on. But then also, even if we get to having the desire to want to enjoy our lives, like this time that's remaining, you also need to have the ability. And that really took us into the coping literature. There's so much literature on internal ways to cope with undesirable challenges, which we all have, and external ways to cope. So for example, it sounds so simple, but the literature shows us that a simple journaling practice where you take the thing, let's to stick with this one of like, yes, you know, losing your partner. And that's like having your arms and legs cut off some often, and getting your journal out and writing about it and putting it all in there and like putting it out on the table of to look at it and feel it and grieve and shake your fist and, you know, not put it like just try to hide it or try to get over it. And then the second part of that is saying, even with the reality of this that I am not minimizing, I'm also going to write down the things that I'm grateful for anyway. Because humans, when you pay attention to something, it's what you see more and more of. So when you wake up in the morning and you go, oh, you know, my back hurts, my daughter's getting a divorce, my husband's sleep apnea kept me awake last night, the dog pooped or whatever, right? When you do that, as humans do, myself included, that's what you see throughout the day. You see the back, the apnea, the poop. But when you do this practice, which is kind of counterintuitive, and open your eyes in the morning, even in the hardship, and go, oh, I'm looking forward to that cup of coffee. I'm grateful that I had a bed to sleep in. Man, you know, that daughter is getting a divorce, but she still is talking with me about it, and we're walking this journey together, and like doing 10 things either in your journal, or I've gotten so I just do them on my fingers and I do it before I even open my eyes. So it looks like I'm just lying there, but I'm actually getting to 10 things. And I have found, and the literature has found, my day is changed. But it sounds so unscientific. It sounds kind of goody two shoes. It sounds kind of too good to be true. And I think that's why sometimes it's so easy to be cynical, super easy to be cynical and just like, But if you want to suffer, keep doing that. But if you want to try to think, I'm going to live 100 years, I'm for sure going to die, but what if I could use that to maximize my time here? And I think that's what our loved ones would want for us too, you know?
Sure. No, that's, you know, well said. Now, in Joyce Ben, you say that gratitude and building meaningful connections are some of the most powerful ways to expand our joy. Can you talk a little about those two factors?
Yes. So gratitude, as I was saying, is powerful. And I like this analogy of, you know, when you, let's say you buy a Nissan Sentra car, and then you go out on the road, and then all of a sudden you're like, there's a Nissan Sentra, there's a Nissan Sentra, or you get engaged and then you notice, oh, she's got a ring, she's got a ring. What you draw your attention to is what you see. And that is the same phenomena, and it's a brain phenomena, and it's what you see in gratitude. So, you know, while it's easy to attend to think about the things that hurt, oh, my left hip hurts, my right hip, my ankle hurts, my hand hurts. If you can, when those things come to your mind, also notice the one that doesn't hurt. So this is true for me right now because I have a really sore knee. I tore the meniscus. Yeah, it bugs me, but every time I think, ow, I think, oh gosh, this other knee really feels quite good. Think about that one, you know? So gratitude is a little bit that way. And it is through gratitude, it also draws connection because humans have, we all have this desire to be around people who do see the good, who do make this choice. And so sometimes my patients who have really shut down and only are seeing the bad things, then they're also socially disconnected because they're really hard to be around. And so what I love about actually all four of these elements of the Joyce-Bound matrix is they all go in the same direction. That is increasing your psychological well-being. But not only that, they have all been shown to increase your lifespan, the length of your life, and your health span. In fact, even epigenetic studies show that inflammation and antiviral load is different as a result of people doing these practices.
Wow.
How incredible is that?
Amazing. Amazing. Now, you mentioned spirituality earlier in our conversation. How important is mindfulness or spirituality? Or talk a little about that as it relates to somebody's joy span.
Yeah, mindfulness can be really powerful and I think sometimes misunderstood, and that we need to have a certain like religious belief. Really, what the research shows is that just the recognition that we are more than just this meat sack. You know, that's like at the lowest common denominator, is that there are experiences in this world that are beyond just. And so when we think of, you know, altruism, for example, like the fact that people want to do things for other people, or that, you know, there are things on earth that we'd be willing to die for, I always think those are examples that we are more than just these selfish bodies. And mindfulness is taking a minute to recognize that and to think, like, I love what Viktor Frankl said in Man's Search for Meaning, because he was in a concentration camp and he was a physician, a psychiatrist. And he said the one thing that we can keep free, regardless of the human's worst situation, is our spiritual freedom. Hmm. And so I have somebody I'm working with who's living with ALS, and that's, you know, a very tough diagnosis. And it gets me choked up because this person who was not very old, was saying that even though the body and the breathing and a lot of stuff isn't working, she still has freedom inside. And I thought that's just what he was. And then I think about things that aren't, you know, that are challenges in my life. And I think, gosh, I have infinite examples of people finding joy in these very hard circumstances because of their ability to recognize like mindfulness and spiritual freedom and our internal lives.
Sure, sure. Thank you for sharing that. I know that's a very tough thing to experience, I'm sure, for you. And
she's so wise, you know, she's, you know, 15 years younger than I am. And infinitely more wise.
Isn't it amazing how you can find those gems that just for whatever reason are dealt a really bad hand, but are able to, I don't want to say look on the bright side, that makes it seem really trite, but
she just said, I'm either going to suffer twice, this is going to suck and I'm going to make it double suck, or this is going to suck and I'm going to think, okay, well, I'm breathing today. I'm alive today. You know, I can look out the window today. And that is something. And really, that's what we all have. We have like just a collection of minutes before we pass away. And I teach undergraduate students. And when I get up on the lectern the first day, I said, let's talk about mortality rates. And they get their pens out. And then I just show a huge circle behind me that's a pie chart that's 100% filled in. I was like, this is the mortality rate, 100%. And none of the burpees and all the things that you were going to infrared saunas, all that, do it. But also know you're still going to die. And you're not doing it wrong. That's what humans do. And it's okay. And it's okay to talk about.
Yep, absolutely. Now you write about the importance of meaning making as we age, how looking back can shape the way we experience the present. What role does storytelling or reflecting on one's past play in cultivating joy?
Yes, there's quite a bit of research on how you kind of make sense of things in the past. And like an example is that my dad was a successful businessman and then went through bankruptcy. And it was a rough patch for sure in many ways. It was very public. He was on the front of the newspaper and all this. And as he got older, before he passed away, we would talk about those times. And he would say, you know something, I at the time had a really big ego. I didn't really make too much time for things that mattered to me. And although I hated that I had to go through that, on the other side, I came up with a much better life. And, you know, I think that is actually a story that we're telling ourselves. And like this thing of like, what is true? I think our truth is what we tell ourselves of how we make sense of things. Sometimes, you know, with older adults, you know, we'll talk about something and I'm like, I would love to hear more about that. Will you tell me about that? And then just our goal as people who work with older adults is then be quiet and listen and ask questions. And people kind of work out the tangles of things and it can make sense to them, or you can say like, wow, this divorce, let's say, that was painful, showed me that it wasn't me entirely. It was both of us. Or, you know, just kind of making sense of things makes a difference in our lives and can help us move forward by untangling the past.
Sure. No, I think that's great. And I've often come back to, I think it's a Shakespeare quote, but, you know, to thine own self be true, and that there is just something really, I think, meaningful in that, you know, I'm the only one that can kind of keep my moral compass, my, you know, guiding myself, and I can't let others kind of, you know, impact that, I guess.
But, yes, exactly.
So this is a question that I ask every Roundtable Talk guest. What are you looking forward to as you age?
I am looking forward to this change, this new longevity. And I am seeing more and more of it where we're standing up to anti-aging instead and shifting the question. So the old question was how not to age. It does not work. The new question is how to age with vitality and strength and humor and growth. And I think I watch senior housing leading the way in that, and that people are not going to be satisfied just in the how it has been. Instead, we're thinking, okay, how I'm watching senior housing make aspirational environments that are filled with growth and connection and people giving back and recognizing their value. And this whole thing of that it's all decline people are starting to go like, wait, no, that's not been my experience. And that's, I'm seeing celebrities step into it. And yeah, there's a lot of still like, oh, you know, about all the looks and whatever, but with more and more role models, and we're actually changing it. So I always think about, there used to be a time where women, you know, weren't allowed to, you know, serve, you know, become a doctor or serve as a leader. And yet now that's changed because we recognize that those old notions are inaccurate. And the same is true and is becoming more and more realized, is that we recognize that this paternalism of like, oh, are older people cute? And shouldn't we do little games to make them, like, no, even with cognitive impairment, adults are adults, and it is not a second childhood, and we are not infantilizing people in any way. Like, we're going, you're more adult now than ever, and you should have your choices for your life. And families are demanding that, and we as older people are demanding that. And to me, that's exciting, and it makes me excited for my old age.
That's great. Well said. And yeah, I do think, you know, it's clear that you're having that kind of impact with just the breadth and depth of people you're reaching with your books. So that's great. Now, in JoySpan, you emphasize that joy isn't only found in peak moments like vacations or celebrations. With that in mind, I'd like to play a little game we're calling the JoySpan Challenge. I'll name some boring or stressful everyday moments, and you suggest a way to find joy in it.
Love it. Okay? I love this game. I've never played this game. Let's do it.
It was designed just for you. So, waiting in a long line at the grocery store.
Yes. Okay.
How can you find joy in that?
So you think everything is a muscle, patience is also a muscle. And so when you're feeling that feeling like, I need to, you can go, ding, opportunity for growth. I'm going to be right here right now with mindfulness. And I'm going to think about the person in front of me and the person behind me. I'm going to send my good energy to them. I might even see if I can help them in any way. Maybe they're with small children, and maybe I could say something nice to the small children to help during their meltdowns at the end. Or maybe I could turn around to the person behind me and give an authentic compliment of going, I love those bright red glasses. Tell me about those. Because you have then sparked joy for the people around you, and you've recognized that feeling impatient also is a choice.
Yep. That's a great point. That's a great point. So next is a stressful doctor's appointment.
Yes. And is it stressful because you might be getting some bad news?
Yeah, yes. Possibly. Yeah.
Yes. So let's make it like that. So you go and you might be finding out about where the...
Some test or
something. Yeah. I'll use a personal example, which is our 25-year-old was diagnosed with a brain tumor last year. And that
Dr.
was
Carey,
not,
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you. And just not expected. It was right before she was supposed to leave for medical school, all packed to go. We get this diagnosis. She's like been perfectly healthy. Like, what in the world? And it was stressful. So we think about we went to a whole bunch of different doctors to figure out what we needed to do. And one thing that was helpful was thinking, every human has something. And this whole thing of being so utterly surprised when you have something is actually not as realistic as recognizing you're human, you're going to have something. And it's not going to be something that you picked, because nobody's going to pick these things. But I don't know anybody who makes it all the way through and doesn't like go, oh, we got this and that and whatever. So we would, when we would think, why me, which we did, we would then say, of course, this is your thing and you know your thing. And the outcome of that is what she has found is that she just can watch the tumor, and every 6 months she gets an MRI, and when it grows, then she'll have a craniotomy. Don't love it. But until then, she went to a medical school that's near her neurologist. So like, didn't feel like it was going to be okay. Sometimes it makes me think, oh, like, why wasn't it me or my 96-year-old mom, but why is it a 25-year-old? But then it's just yes, that is how life is. And actually, when I first got the diagnosis, I went to a group of 90-year-olds who are beautiful, women that I know. And I cried and I told them the situation and they were good listeners. But then they were sharing like their kids had all had things. And one of them shared that their grandkids had passed away. And she said, like, watching her daughter mourn the loss of a grandchild. And I thought, I'd never even thought about that with these long lives, that there is that too. But yes, the human experience is going to have all of that. We're all going to have our share of it.
Yep, yep. And I think the human experience is a good way to sum up a lot of it, because that's what it takes to be human, right? I mean, as you were talking about spirituality and mindfulness and some of the other, that's what makes us human.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And we have a, you know, as we said, limited time here. How can we best, sometimes I feel like it's like somebody has given us a handful of M&Ms and it's our life. And then we're going through eating it. And then we're complaining of like, oh, I wish I was still 20. It's like, no, you ate all those M&Ms. Each one was a year. You're now this age, but gosh, don't, I mean, you still have some in your hand. And so even with the yucky raisins that are in there too, they're still, don't overlook that there is still choice.
And I think lots of M&Ms in the bowl too.
Yeah. So it's just down to a choice. Even though you feel like you don't have a choice, you do have a choice. We all do.
Sure. Another one, having trouble sleeping at night.
Yes, that's a common one, isn't it? And you're lying there thinking, sleeping so important. It's good for my brain, but I'm not sleeping. Is that bad for my brain? Now I think I'm getting dementia as I'm laying here.
Yeah. How do you find joy in that?
So that one I'm going to defer to my 96-year-old mom, my mother, Betty, who has kind of, because I turned the camera on her, she's become a little social media influencer. So she has millions and millions of people watching these little unprofessional videos I make of her. And she has been practicing these joy span techniques, I'd say about probably, she's probably 80 at the time. So, but she is the best version of herself right now. She is beloved, engaged, lives independently, sharper than me, just amazing woman. And wasn't always that way. And what she says when she doesn't sleep is she, the next day I said, how was your night? Oh, I didn't sleep. But I know tonight it's another chance. And then she says, you don't die of not sleeping. And so, you know, you can tell yourself again, like every human experiences it sometimes. Yes, we want to get it, but it's not going to last forever. You're not going to be awake for the rest of your life. You'll eventually get exhausted enough that you'll crash.
That's a great point. You do have to, you know, and again, it might sound trite, but look on the bright side sometimes.
She does. And she, you know, she'll be, I know, like awake all night. And then she has a lot of gastrointestinal problems. And then so she's awake all night. And I know that she's had diarrhea all morning. And then she'll still say like, okay, yeah, I'll still go to that card game. And I think, wow, she's tough.
I love that. Yeah.
And it takes being tough. And so sometimes I think, ironically, I think joy span is a little bit of tough love with yourself, like a little bit of like, okay, friend, you didn't sleep and you have diarrhea and you're bummed about this. Okay, let's go.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's right. Because, you know, misery kind of begets misery if you let yourself wallow in it, right?
Yeah.
So last one, doing a household chore that you don't particularly like. You know, for me, that would be probably cleaning out the cat litter. But how can you find joy in some sort of a household chore?
Yeah, two ways. Every household chore, put music on with it and then like really crank it up and be ridiculous in your doing it. And then the other is humor. So a lot of these things like that cat litter, you know, like you got to just laugh. Like, I can't believe that this pet is making me clean up after them. You know,
exactly right.
Yeah. I once got for our cat litter one that was electronic, like automated, and it did it itself. And so the cat was in there and then the thing kind of made a noise. The cat jumped out and then pooped on the floor. Like,
oh, that's great.
We have to laugh. And if you can laugh at yourself, you'll have endless material because, you know,
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. We just, if it's too rough not to laugh.
Absolutely. So You know, social connection is such a recurring theme in your work. We talked about that a couple times already in our conversation. We know that isolation is one of the biggest barriers to joy later in life. What advice would you give to older adults who feel isolated or disconnected?
Yes. So the definition of loneliness that UCLA uses in its loneliness scale is wanting more social interaction than you currently have. And I love that definition because you can be lonely in a marriage, you can be lonely in a group, you can not be lonely by yourself. So I think like disentangling like what this means. So asking yourself, do I want more social interaction than I currently have? And if we're honest, all of us sometimes would say like, yes, you know, I have had a number of Friday nights, Saturday nights where there's really nothing going on. And I wish that there was. And the way to tap into adequate social connection for the 100-year life is just one way. And that one way is to be proactive. When people come to me and they come to me all every day and they say, I have nothing to look forward to. Nobody invites me to something. I have nothing, you know, going on for Thanksgiving or another holiday. I then listen carefully because we need to be good listeners. But then after I've listened, I then ask the question, tell me about the plans that you've made, the invitations you've extended, like how you have invited people over. Like, tell me about that. And
that's
invariably
a great point.
They say, oh, well, I'm not the one who does that. And this man the other day said, well, it's my wife who does that. And now with her cognitive impairment, she can't do it. And that's why I'm isolated. And so like, I understand that it is a shift, but it's this one sentence, be that friend who remembers that it's been 5 years since your mom's passing, who offers to drive you to chemo, who says, I'm going to make a dinner reservation and can you come? So you got to really put yourself out there. And when we have mobility limitations, and I say when, because if we live long enough, there'll be mobility and vision and hearing limitations, which can be tough. We need to get even more creative. So if you're living in a congregate living situation, pushing yourself to knock on the door of somebody and say, hey, you know, there's something going on. Would you want to go down together? And then it takes a little kissing of frogs because maybe the first person says no. And that kind of hurts our ego when somebody says no to us. But knowing how important it is, like go to the next five and to be very kind of intentional about it. Your social portfolio is similar to your financial portfolio in that you need to recognize, write down, how many friends do I have that I'm close with? Who do I wish I was closer with? And how can I kind of pursue them and go after it and diversify my social portfolio in the same way that I diversify my economic portfolio? And one really good way is to have younger friends because my mom at 96, she's outlived 99% of her friends. So luckily we had read this research about having younger people in your life. So about 20 years ago, she started reaching out to who she calls the youngs, and they're people in their 70s and 80s. And she gets together with the youngs, and the youngs love that they're called the youngs in their 80s.
That's great. That's beautiful. That's great. So, you know, you were kind of alluding to some of this, but how can senior living communities design experiences that enhance joy?
Yes. So if you get the book, I put joy practices in there. And so it's all in one place. And I wish those four things would have spelled out an acronym, and I tried hard to make it zippy, but it was just the words that it was. But it starts with a G and it ends with a G, and in the middle is CA, and I'm from California, so it helps for me, and maybe people could remember that. But those four of growing, connecting, adapting, and giving. And within senior communities and senior housing, we have such an opportunity because we now have a vocabulary to think with our families, with our staff members, with the older adults who make the community. We can be saying like, this is great because it's really fostering connection. And we know from the research that connection does X, Y, Z. Or when somebody says, I am just so mad because my macular degeneration is making it so that I can't do all the things I love to do. We can say, yes, that is so hard to adapt to this kind of situation. Let's talk about the tools that you have. Have you tried these kinds of things? So it's really just kind of a vocabulary in the same way that we can't just walk around and go, exercise. We need to talk about, oh, we understand strength and the role that it plays, or we understand flexibility is what enables us not to shuffle when we walk. So just, I think senior communities having that vocabulary can really make a difference with meaningful program that is next generation and that it is what people are going to come to expect.
Love that. Love that. So now how do you hope JoySpan will influence policy, caregiving, and senior services?
Yes. So when I was getting my degree, it was a PhD in gerontology and public policy. And so it really was starting with, okay, how can policy shape our aging experience? And what I've come to learn is that our thinking also really shapes our policy. And so the thinking that older people are less than, older people, you know, aren't going to be as discriminating in their desires, or that they can't somehow like continue to learn new things and contribute, and how much we have to give, that impacts both our policies, for example, in senior housing or in, you know, caregiving arrangements in the home setting, and also our policies in, you know, in our state and local governments. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one thing of recognizing that old aging, that old less than infantile, like, yep. No. And so even like the words that we use matter, right? The other day I met somebody and she said, well, it's nice that you're with those elderlies. And I said, do you imagine, you know, when you get older, like, do you think you feel good to be elderlies? Because I'm just curious. And she's like, oh, well, no, not me. And so is really thinking through that, like putting our shoulders back on behalf of ourselves and those. And people sometimes say, who is JoySpan for? It's like, is this a book that I should buy for older people? Yes, maybe. But I think we start with ourselves. It's for anybody who's aging, and we're all aging. And these practices that help between the ages of, let's say, 93 to 94, also really impact your life between 23 and 24. So the earlier that we start, the better. And the more that we don't say, like, this is for older people. It's like, no, this is another word for aging is living. And how can our policies maximize living, knowing that we are all going to die, and the resources that we sometimes that we pour into just keeping people alive maybe isn't the best use of resource, because death is an okay outcome, but not living, that's not an okay outcome.
Yep, that's great. Well said. Now, one of our most recent guests on this podcast was Rick Robinson from AARP's Age Tech Collaborative. Rick and his team are working to accelerate technology that helps seniors as they age. What role do you see technology playing in enhancing or hindering JoySpan?
Yes, I see it both ways. So I see it as making it less personal. And, you know, I've seen that, for example, like social media. Yes, we're connecting with people. There's a lot of good. I have 300,000 followers, many of whom are 80 and older, that, you know, we interact in, it is good. But then is it, you know, having less in-person connection? And the same thing with AI. Like, yes, we can harness it for good, but also is it going to make it more impersonal? So I guess what I would, and I worked in technology. I worked on a startup that was a tablet for older adults and a way to connect without getting all the tech challenges in the way. And there was a lot of good and potential. So, and I think we're going to go that way, right? It's going to be AI. It's going to be smart homes and robots and, you know, automated kinds of things. But maybe we as professionals in the aging network can every step of the way be questioning, how can we make human connection and human dignity and choice and freedom and the ability to make decisions even that we don't agree with. You know, like some people should continue to have that freedom.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of yes, and let's also be
really
careful.
There's no stopping it, right?
Yeah, it's that the genie's out of the bag.
That's
and I
right.
think sometimes it's coming.
Yep. So one question before we get to our final question. You're well known for your research and advocacy in the area of elder abuse prevention and response. You even co-founded the Elder Abuse Forensic Center, one of the first of its kind in the nation. Now, from your perspective, what progress have we made in addressing elder abuse, and where do you think the biggest gaps remain?
I love that question. Yes. So I think recently we have not been making progress in addressing the rampant multi-billion dollar industry of frauds and scams, and also even family members taking advantage of older adults. So I don't feel like, oh man, look at how far we've come, baby. But I think this potential of getting in earlier, and what elder abuse hates is light. So shining a light of like, that's why connection, like, by keeping people together and connected and seeing people and making people recognize their value and their growth and their contribution, I think can fortify people so they don't end up in situations of vulnerability that people prey upon. So
sure. Well, I so admire you, and thank you for your work in that, not just in you know, Joy Span and all of the kind of the thought leadership that you've provided to our world.
Well, thank you. And thank you for all that you're doing and for all your listeners are doing. It really makes a difference. And it's really a privilege to work in this area.
It really is. We're all in this together. So the last question, what have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
Yes, my younger self was mistaken in othering older people. I was a young gerontologist, and I would think, oh, older people are this or that or somehow different. And I had kind of like a kindness that was really kind of based on condescending. And now, thank heaven, I really recognize it's just people. And yep. You happen to catch me at this age, I could be 97, I could be 7 years old. People really are just people, and the same wants and desires and dignity that we've always wanted is what, quote, older people want. So I'd wish I'd known that earlier.
Hey, that's sage advice for any of the folks coming up in this field, at any age really. But thank you, Dr. Carrie Bernite. But you said you often go by Dr. Carrie or just Carrie. I know you're not formal about that, but thank you. You've been very generous with your time, with your points of view. And again, thank you for giving the world all of the concepts, but also the book, Joy Span, and the work that you've been doing with elder abuse and such. Really appreciate that. Thank you, Dr. Carrie.
Thank you. I'd love to connect with your listeners, and I'd love to work together. And I just really love this podcast. So thank you very much for having me on it.
That's great. You have such good energy. And thank you also to Dave Schaffner, our producer, and Matt Campbell, our engineer. So we'll see you next time on Roundtable Talk. Thanks again, Dr. Carrie.
Bye-bye.